do.
All right.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, Thomas Marwinski, all the way from Norway. He made it.
Push the bit. First the bit, and then it's a charge, and then push it through.
Fetch the knot!
Right here.
Maybe
I've
done here.
Only a bit. That's the first point, and then after the pen has set, then.
Oh, okay. You got a great picture of the floor. You got a picture of the floor.
A few slots.
Okay.
Those are your rules.
The presentation will be about developing settlements for middle-earth gaming. We had a more theoretical presentation around speech by Chris, and now we'll talk to you about what I think is essential or important or should be considered when designing real settlements for gaming. So we had what have we so far? Yeah, of course, the verb. Modules, a lot of them, in about 18 years or so existed. 100 or more supplements of varying quality and volume, adventure, regular modules, thematic modules, the low range help. Then after that, for about 6 years, at least the license was around for 6 years, it's lapsing now. We had a lot of the Rings role playing game from Decipher with not so many supplements. Even if you consider the smaller run or the shorter time, and they focused on rules books, on the rules specific things. Regional modules, world describing, world building was nearly non-existent due to the restricting license. And of course, other hands, we know it very well. We had 34 issues with a quite wide variety of contribution adventures, magic modules, whatever you had, magic sections. Magic was a quite popular topic there, probably because in their times back then, there was a system with a license, and the magic system is not very well suited for literal. In fact, it's quite bad for it. And, of course, a lot of other fan material in organized groups or individuals, nearly countless things, specifically for Middle-earth, or adapted to Middle-earth, or absolutely not, is out there on the map. So what were the basic approaches for these different systems, commercially or fan-made? In Merck, the license was officially based only on the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbits, but additionally, they took Silmarillion and Finnish Tales into it, despite they having not the official license, but in the better days back then, it was a bit more slack then. Tolkien Enterprises was not enforcing it so badly as they do now. From where the game system was very generic, it was nothing special designed for Middle-earth, they took their normal roadmaster system, a very generic system, and more or less an AD&D flow with a bit other rules, and scale it down a bit, and then we had merged. So it was not at least target related, probably because to get it out in the market back then. What it has was a wide variety of target research for, not for the rules, but for the regional modules. So there are specific modules for Angmar and Umbar were one of the first. And as a tendency, the canonical approach towards the modules is concerning Tolkien research grew better until the end. So the last modules, especially in Merv's second edition, were more concerned with first researching what the Tolkien written about this specific topic before something was written about it. That was not the approach, especially for many of the first edition modules. For the Lord of the Rings role-playing game, we have the license is principally the same as the verb, but it is much more strictly enforced. We have that the game system is very well supported. It was designed with Tolkien in mind, so they had a look at the Lord of the Rings and at the Hobbit and see what magic effects were observable there or depicted there, and try to translate these topics or these phenomena into game terms. Something worked in the Middle East. And it supplements, due to the license, were focused on the Lord of the Rings alone. So yet there were no material besides this specific setting, either temporal or even in space. On the other hand, we had a wide variety in research, from very little to the more enthusiastic approach to almost scholarly, especially in the later issues on the other hand. And the other kind of materials basically made the same with a very, very wide variance and approach, and nothing general can be said about all that. So the question remains when the module or another supplement is designed, how much working research should be put into it. Of course, both approaches with a lot of research and little research have advantages and disadvantages. To begin for, when we have a little research, the advantages are, of course, they're easy and quick to make. You have not to look for many issues. You can write all along. It is known to a wide range of authors due to the little public knowledge. So you don't have to know anything about it. You don't need to have to read many books. You can write on. And of course, in close connection with these points, there's a lot of contribution possible, of course, because many people can write for that. And we have a wide array of possible supplements. The disadvantages, of course, are there's a heavy tendency towards generic fantasy cliches. So many people who are enthusiastic about it want to translate their favorite system and perhaps also their favorite monsters, creatures, and so on, and transplant it directly to the Middle Earth setting without any regards whether they fit there or not. This was the case for a role monster. Many of the creatures there, especially for role monster, were all nearly the same defined in D&D or whatever else game system, and nearly translated the game terms comfortable to work a role monster. And due to that, they are prone to a low compatibility with the writings spoken and left us either other economical, such as the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit, or the more diverse source material consisting of the Silmarillion, History of Middle and Unfinished Tales, and so on. So the other way around, when we have a lot of heavy research, the advantages are, of course, quite the contrary from the previous issue. We have a high compatibility with Tolkien sources, of course. When I put a lot of research into it and regard these issues by designing the supplement, it is very likely to be good, compatible to the writing of Tolkien. And the high degree of suspension of disbelief, this secondary world, matches, if it's very well written, the ones that we find in the original books. Of course, it's a question of style and personal preferences, but if it's well written, the level is already quite high. The disadvantages are, of course, due to the circle of potential authors is much smaller, because I have a very high level entry to be able to participate in that. So it also gets very easily, especially when it's not very well communicated, an elitist badge. So, oh, these are the knowledgeable boys, they don't want any other guys who know a little bit less, and they have everything, they know everything, and when I contribute something, it's bullshit because they know it better than they have written so many other things. And they think it might lead to discrimination of those that are not as knowledgeable, but and very enthusiastic. So many things I have to read a lot. So when I get there, the first one said, okay, read these 1,000 pages and after that you can come back and participate here. Of course, many people are not very happy with that. And due to the to these previous issues, we have, of course, smaller output in numbers of supplements of whatever nature, because the high degree of discussion and research in content designing that leads to high much time to make that, and of course then I get less fabrications or supplements as well. So this is a bit a cartoon from an old German fanzine or negative gaming magazine. Here, this guy sits a bit something like that. He says, "Oh, does that it count or what?" You see this opera-like figure. And says, "Oh, I got the song from the film. Does count or does it not?" So it's a bit similar to those. I have a bit research and okay, I can use it all. Okay. So, and the concrete example where I will explain this a bit more, at least the approach I prefer and I think is in the end the better, the more satisfying, is in this mapping project. You have seen that in the first issue of Open Minds, the big essay and the Open Mind maps about the approach to mapping hardware on a global scale. To begin with, and we had another map, but in the very beginning, of course, was a map that was published with Merck and made by Pete Fairman in the early 80s, and especially in gaming circles that treat with Middle Earth, this map is the most widely accepted, and many people will probably still use it. And then, on the other hand, I myself, I must admit it, made a contribution. And this map, this new continental map, was based solely on the gut feeling that this relatively small middle family continent should be a bit bigger, because there were a ambiguous quote about our Middle Earth being the predecessor of our own real world, but only in ages past. It was this quote from the letters that led to that, where Tolkien says that the time between the fall of Barad-dûr and our days is a few thousand years. Take 6,000 years, take or less a few more, or less, but in principle, it's only a matter of time and not of the principle idea behind that. So, this map was a result. You see in color here is the old map made by Pete Fairman, and overlay is this line art image of this new continent. You see, the especially east-west distance has been greatly enlarged, and the southern continent below the family continent has been attached as well. Of course, these new lands gave great opportunities for designing new realms, new histories, climates, and so on and so on. And for the time being, back then, on the other hand, I was satisfied with the new map. It got published in other hands. It was very thumbs up. And it has been used, well, it has been used for some years by now. This map was quite easy and quick to produce. It did not take me very long with it. And it's wide range of many high fantasy possibilities. They were wide and a long way from the regions Tolkien described himself. And so there was much leeway for producing and introducing new ideas, or our own ideas. It is only seemingly, superficially, based on Tolkien, on the quote I've shown on the slide before, because it was not really developed. It hung on this single quote without further researching or at least checking whether Tolkien had else written on mapping in Arda or designing maps himself, or at least sketches of maps. And this is led to a little small compatibility with his thoughts, as he expressed firstly and very elaborately in the Avakambakanta, the History of Middle Earth, Volume 5. Unfortunately, Torkti never further developed his world. The histories, the written histories, and the descriptions of ruins and geography had changed after that, but he never made any maps more matching these, and the Avakambakanta maps is the only thing we have in that region, that department. And the widespread use of this new map that I had shown, had just shown, led of course to the problems that the products and reams, the other modules that were based on this map, of course, inherited the same flaws that this map was produced with. So, as a conclusion, I came to the conclusion last year or a few years before that basically a new map should be made, and this was a much higher level in Tolkien research to amend the errors that were made with this map. You can see the maps here all depicted up on the wall, and what are the characteristics of this new development? They were based primarily on that, what we could glean from Tolkien in his books. Either the maps in the Avakambakanta or the sketches in the Avakambakanta, and the descriptive text that we find in all the volumes, especially the later volumes of the History of Middle-earth. But only as a second priority, gaining resources were used. We had the goal to merge that what Tolkien has written with the continent. We had system from Kingfandom and use that was comfortable and drop that was not comfortable. And every other gaming source that was not comfortable to the results we need for the first one was simply dropped if it was totally unusable or it was changed and adapted so that it fit. As a rule, we think that this map provides a much more solid base for further development. Of course, there's never an end point where we say this is absolute truth and there's not much more to improve, but at least is a much better research and less map than the one that was published in other hands. The great advantage of this new map is that the regions of interest for the vast majority of gamers, that's the Northwest that Tolkien had described, remain untouched or nearly untouched by these changes, though that only those regions lying far away have been changed. But even if these are of interest to some gamers and some developers, it surely is not the focus of the vast majority for those gamers interested in role-playing in Middle-earth. So this is the map, or one of the maps. It shows us the third age of Middle-earth. Basically, we have the Fandom continent that has been adapted in the northwest, which I will talk to about later. And these are the remnants of all the first and second age structures that we have devised for it. Here you can see what I have just shown, the northwest. Here on the right side, this is the northwest as depicted and made by Pete Fambler in his continental map from 1981, I guess.
Yes.
So the coastline here in the northwest is very rugged and jagged, and there are many fjords. And so we all know that, especially from the northern waste module that was one of the last published by Merck. And this is the one that we use here. This much more smooth coastline has been gleaned from the History of Middle-earth Volume 7, where we see at least a sketchy map of these regions beyond that that's shown in the Lord of the Rings and Unfinished Tales. So we chose to use that, all these regions here that's nearly the same scale, at least nearly the same scale, these regions that were much care for the Northern Waste module, and there was much regions there or people there described. We did not want to drop it entirely because it's a very good module in our eyes. So we chose to move that a bit beyond the reach of the maps, as shown in history number 7. We moved it so that it's just beyond the border of these maps. Of course, it is an island, as you see, another peninsula as it was former. But this problem can easily be overcome because it's lying at such a high altitude. We suppose that the ocean in between is mostly frozen over, and so people can get going quite easily, and only in very extraordinary warm summers. Some of the ice in between will melt and not be passable to travelers without a ship. Yeah, this is the map from the first age and overlaid with the second age. So you can see we made a few maps to show the changes that appeared between the several ages in one map. Here in light gray, it's not very good here. We see the one as it was in the first age, and the heavy, the dark, the black lines depict the geography as it was then later in the second age. Of course, these maps are not meant at the end, so to say, but the basis for more future uses. And we have already gotten a few ideas, such as thematic maps. First, of course, would be of interest, geobotanic or forest cover map. At least now we have only the outline, and it would, of course, be very interesting to see where we envision forest cover, or big forest, small forest, or these vegetation zones, because these factors already heavily influence other factors like migration routes for major races. We have to know that that man and elves as well were born in the east of Middle Earth, and they must have got somewhere to the west. And especially for those interested in history and settlement patterns, it might be very interesting simply where they got past and perhaps what they left there. As I said already, the settlement patterns at different times on a grand scale. So we can say in this region we have a group of men, and not only as a regional module, say men are there. So we can say they came from there, went over there, and not everything was settled, but there were Apache settlement pattern and along certain routes, migration must have become, so to say, along rivers or other features that were easily traversable and offer good opportunities for sustaining the people on the march. And of course, regional maps and modules, when you want to describe a certain smaller area in more detail, you have a basic map, a continental map, where you can zoom in and work out your area of interest in greater detail. So what are the conclusions? We and I think that detailed research for producing supplements for Wittelberg pays in the end, and since the resulting project is much more based on solid ground, we are aware of the fact that it cannot be ever the single and the last word, and that there's a continued development, and one has to accept that if new facts show up or a new view is favored in the future, perhaps existing modules must be changed, adapted, or simply accepted that it is not compatible with the newer development, perhaps a better one. But that is not a principal issue, and we think that one should not stick very dogmatically to something that has already been produced or published and never change it again simply because it has already been written. We think that a set of rules or guidelines that are set before to begin with are very useful, because then we can direct or organize a group working on a certain aspect much more easily when everyone knows, okay, we have to abide to the following guidelines in making contributions, and so the moderator or editor has not to make this all himself, and it's getting much more smooth than as if he has to explain to everyone, okay, you cannot do that, you cannot do that, and then you must do that, that, that. The better the initial research, we think that the slimmer the chances are that we have to amend it later on a very grand scale and significant part. Of course, no one knows for sure, and it can be that it has to be changed later again, but the better research you do now, the better off you are. We think also that when developing your supplement, you should check whether the relevant basic issues have been addressed to. So if I write a regional module on a specific kingdom, realm, or whatever, I should look as the basic issues like geography, geobotanics, climate, and so on, has it been already addressed or not? If not, it is very advisable that we make some guidelines or some basic issues available for that, since when I do not, I write straight ahead only, and later I think or others said, oh no, you, that cannot be because these are certain rules, and so this does not function. And if this is then applied to certain key aspects of the module, much work has been done and many energy wasted, and this has to be done. So it's very advisable to have these basic issues clear before setting off with your contributions to higher levels that work upon these basics. And for us, it also seems important to concentrate on one project at a time. We have a group of 3, 4, 5, or 6 people. Of course, many ideas show up. We have a map and we can do that. And in this region, we should concentrate, or in this region, we should adapt the existing characters and so on, the histories, and then the one in charge has to say, okay, very nice ideas, but now we are focusing on the global map, on the global scheme, you should keep that in mind for later, but now please leave it aside, we have to finish this first. Yeah, then, damit bin ich am Ende. That's the end. I thank you for attention. There's already a cartoon from the same magazine as well. I guess I do not have to translate it into English. It's quite self-explaining the approach many world players have, not seeing the setting, either middle or something else, but only the game rules. These groups of adventurers see an orc, and instead of seeing an orc, they see 10 experience points. Okay, that was it.
I have one of future uses of your maps. If you're going to do like a geobotanical map, the maps for future uses, if you're going to use these maps as a basis for like showing tree growth and things like that, what scale will you use? Will you use larger scale than what you have here on the wall?
The ones here on the wall are basically the basic scale. It's about 3 feet by 3 feet or so, rough, as a rough measure, because it should show continental scale. So, as in the accompanying essay, we say it is not intended to show detail, cannot, of course. It should only show the general shape of the continent, of the geographical features, and smaller issues can always be resolved in a regional module. For instance, here the line that depicts the continent or the landmass, for example, and this scale is about 10 kilometers wide, so there's much leeway for a smaller scale there. So they're not designed to be printed very slow, they're very small, because then you won't be able to see many things. Hopefully.
So will you, as you're developing, blow up certain areas, enlarge that, and then add that? So for example, the Northwest another area, will you show like the forestation growth blown up in just that area in more detail?
That could be used. That you when you work out a regional micro, you have to first show this whole map or at least a significant portion of that, and then make an enlargement of the area that that they are special interest in.
One more question. Will you make these what's the license? The GNU?
Oh.
Will these be GNU free documentation?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
So anyone will be able to use them?
Yes. Everyone take them. They take them as they are or modify them according to their own wishes. It's a free license, but we have made clear that's always in the choice of the authors that we will use these maps for further developments. One issue I have not mentioned is, let me show that. Okay, this is for the third age map. This whole mapping project has always been seen as a preview at the annual meeting of the German Tolkien Society about 1.5 weeks ago. Those people attending were quite fond of the maps and essay as well, but the one issue they had with it was here the third age map, which of course differs the most from the previous ages and the Umbrakanta inspired maps. And despite being okay with the general shape of the continent, most people do not like very much the southern areas of the peak feminine continent, especially this between the main continent and this broken off area in the south was not met with very much love. So it might be imaginable to update this map so that perhaps here is a bay, a large bay in the western area. We modify the maps accordingly, that here we have a solid land bridge as a remnant of the features of the first and second age, and so make this whole area more or less connected. But of course, and we are absolutely aware of that, it would lead to the dumping or at least severe changes in this south or south eastern areas of Middle Earth, or at least the feminine Middle Earth. But because this region is not very well documented or covered by regional modules, that would, in our opinion, be not so great a problem. The western coast, the western regions should be left, but I guess that is not the very great issue. Yeah?
Just to finish answering the question about the GNU free documentation license, the way it works is it's still a copyright. A lot of people call it copyleft. You say this is who created it. If you want to add to it, modify it, redistribute it, that's fine. You just have to give attribution to the original creators and then any amendments along the way. It's basically the same as the open source license for software development. You just give credit to the people to where credit is due, and you can build on it however you wish.
Absolutely, of course. And as for every product published for role playing, be it Middle Earth or something else, where you have different versions of the same thing, be it in different editions or due to the different authors, no one is forced to use a specific setting or geography in that case. If you don't like it, simply drop it and do something else.
Also, as far as the magazine being under the GFDL, each author can decide whether they want it to be copyright or copyleft. The preference is that everything is under the GNU license, but it is up to each contributor to say, I want mine to be under normal copyright protection, please don't redistribute. And that will be mentioned in those specific articles that are that way. Does that answer that question for you?
Yes.
Great.
I had two comments to make, both of which are entirely supportive of this. I think this is one of the most important projects that's been undertaken since the demise of MERP. And I'm totally with you on the need to do as much research as possible for the foundational efforts in terms of mapping and describing general patterns, because then those who want to do the higher level material in terms of histories, adventure plots, and so on will have not just a foundation that's understandable to themselves, but also something that they can easily share with other authors.
Absolutely.
And I think one very important aspect of this whole process, which is unlike the original Pete Fenlon map, is that this is a public collaborative process that is documented. In other words, that sure, there will always be disagreements about specifics, and that's entirely within the license of any creative mind. But I think that the fact that we actually have the documentation of what were the thoughts that went into drawing it this way rather than that way will make conversation about the disagreements, should make them much more simple, but also should help us to lead us forward to better mutual understanding of where we might go with it. So I think that's absolutely essential. You know, we can't ask, most of us can't ask Pete Fenlon, you know, why he did this or that. But now we can, so that's a great benefit. And I think that you know, the fact that it takes a lot of effort and a lot of work to do it will simply mean that it'll be that much more worthwhile. The second comment, really, was a comment of how, what implications it might have for people who have to now change either the area they're working on or some other. I think this is nothing new. I think this is the condition of doing role-playing development in another author's world. Namely that we all work within creative constraints. And if the creative constraint to be conforming to that author means moving something into an island, I would obviously say, great, now I have to figure out why that is, and now I have to figure out what new kinds of stories I can tell about it that I couldn't before. So I think that it's essential to the whole creative process to recognize the kind of limitations that you do here. So those are just two comments in heavy support.
Yeah, the first comment you had was very important for us, not only to present a new map and say, okay, we think this is better than anything else, but to say why we think it should be done this way and not another.
Check the chat room real quick, see if there's any questions there. We'll see. Fortunately, everybody in your time zone is asleep because it's like 2 a.m. over there.
Okay.
But we will have this as a downloadable audio file later so that people will be able to listen to it in Europe. And I know a lot of people said they wish that the time zone had worked out because they really wanted to ask the questions. But maybe as they listen to it, they'll probably email us and I can forward those to you. And you can answer, we can create a dialogue on the website to answer and develop it that way. So, no further questions, anyone? Okay, let's call that a wrap. Good job.
Thank you.
That is, we had in the other hands a very good essay about the lost islands here in the northern part of the remnants of Valerian in the Northlands from Jeff Irwin.
And we have this area here
as called the Muro Rageras, and he identified it as a remnant, a broken of remnant of Aman when the man was removed from the realm of hidden things. So, but we are a bit skeptical whether this should be really viewed as the part of a man, but either way, you could interpret it for your own campaign as a part of a man that broke off because in the Third Age it's not accessible at all, or you could interpret it as a part of the new lands that were accessible and created after the Akkadian. So either way, then you can use it there. And because the Jeff, in a bit different shape, but basically in a similar position, had these island or this landmass there, we thought it might be a good idea to include it as well with an alternative explanation, whether as a part of the old lands remaining in the mortal world or a part of the new lands now accessible. Either way round is useful.
Well, where's Angra?
Here, right on the far end.
On the old map, does it still exist?
Yeah, that's a very tricky issue. Because in the Silmarillion, when you look at the Silmarillion map, Angband is excluded. And that's a very interesting thing, because in the older sketches of Tolkien concerning the histories of Valerian, he had Angband very close to the Northlands. And you can see these mountains on the bit more to the east, at about this spot here, there was Angband. It was depicted on the maps. But later, Tolkien changed his view and moved Angband much further to the north. We have in the Silmarillion, the published Silmarillion, the famous quote that between Menegroth and Angband there were 450 miles in a direct line. And when you have a look at the scale of the Valerian maps, as shown in history, 450 miles is right here. So these three big mountains are Angband. Absolutely not comfortable with this old southern position. So this southern position, which is depicted on the map, is only available in the older versions of the Silmarillion or Valerian legends, and not in the newer ones. The newer ones it was moved to the north, but the accompanying map was never updated by Tolkien. And so we guess that Christopher Tolkien deliberately left Angband out on his map in Silmarillion because he did not want to decide on a southern or northern position. Because some features of the old maps are not compatible with the new developments later, and the other way around.
So but the story itself,
the story in the Silmarillion is, when you look at it, have a very close look and compare it with the sources and available in the history of Middle-earth, it's a piece together from different periods of Tolkien's writings. They are more or less good merged by Christopher Tolkien, but they are not product of the same period of writing, and so they are not fully compatible internally. It looks compatible, but when you have a very, very close analysis, you see they are not compatible. They are contradicting things or
location.
Contradicting descriptions of the same issue. So we had to decide on the position. And we took the latest one that positioned Angband 450 miles from Menegroth accordingly at Matthew.
That makes more sense to me.
Argalon, near these wide plains, is prairie like plain, is very, very great. So we had discussed it extensively in the battles of Valerian, in the Nirmen and the Nordia, in the Dagra Aglareb. All the Elven armies must have been marched quite long.
They have to be in the plains, right?
Yeah, they have to be in the plains. But when you look at the distances and possible marches and distances covered by renewable armies, and as well as the hypothetical armies by Tolkien, especially the famous ride of the Roe River, which is a quite tough thing if you consider a fully armored army plus train in its vein. Then it is entirely possible. Then Tolkien himself says that the Noldor had a watch here which heavy contingent or perhaps wholly created out of cavalry. So all of these conflicts in Arkdal were probably mostly cavalry and at least mounted infantry that could move more rapidly.
This is one of the interesting implications of moving the area of Bimavar west, is that is any of Angband there now?
Yeah.
That makes an interesting possibility.
We had to move the mount of Hiflum to the north because there was no way for Morgoth armies to circumvent Hiflum but to march on the very edge of Middle-earth and on the coast south again, as said in Silmarillion and the other sources. So Hiflum, the one that is depicted on the Silmarillion map, is only that area, but about that area. And the greatest part here is not depicted, and to have a watch on Angband, either in the southern, especially the northern position, it's only possible if you have a heavy cavalry force that cover a greater area efficiently and at any time.
Well, what about a Tumno?
That must be located here. This is a post-Tumno map, because these the area in green, the originally area in green, are envisioned, are described by Tolkien as a semi-circle here in the north. And as in the Battle of Tumno, they roughly in the middle of the Arian Empire. And when the Valar came to him, battle with him after the awakening of the Elves, we suppose, and that is said in the essay as well, that the land here was so heavily damaged that this Vale of the Tomb was created as a result of the Battle of Powers. Because Peter Tolkien uses the same word for the destruction of Tumno, as related to the destruction of Angband. And he says that after the War of Wrath, that Angband was unroofed. He also said that the ocean spilled into many places, and eventually the whole area, or the greatest part of the area, was submerged. And he uses the same vocabulary when Tumno was unroofed in the war and in the Battle of the Powers. So we suppose that in this later version, a version of the legendarium, that the Tumno was destroyed and the great and the water, the ocean spilled in afterwards. And that's all right. That's one of the issues Eric has as well, because he was a provider in the East that is more comfortable with his personal views.
I actually like that idea right there.
And we have this up with the other minds the thing we have covered almost every relevant topic considered why we choose to make it this way and not another one.
Yeah, well that just makes sense to me. So where would you place Angband on the other maps? In the original Northern Waste positioning, it was supposed to be a couple miles south of, I think, one of these islands here. You're not going to enter your game, so.
Unless you have a good part of divers.
Wow.
This keeper might not be sufficient.
Oh, no. You need a little
while more. It's
invisible. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but underneath, there might be easy underground passages.
Absolutely, yes. So we suppose that would be an interesting topic for a follow-up. Using this whole basic geography, depicting at least the major passages of the underdeeps throughout Middle-earth.
That would be really neat to see something.
Yeah. And as well, the reckoning places of the course, one of my favorite subjects.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's also one of the major issues with Eric as well.
Yes. I remember that now, just because Tolkien does give some notion of how far each of the awakening places would be.
Yeah. Oh, yes. He says that the awakening place of the Longbirds, of course, the Gundabad, mountain, would be the two other tribes that work in the north of the Arendi. That is basically, of course, the tribes in the district of the area of Norbert and Belfast.
What is
the
Arendi?
No, not the Arendi, it's the awakening place of the walls. Tolkien describes that the other two awakening places were two pairs of dwarves, the world, were greater, as great or greater as between the Eric Levine and the Gunther Buttonhorn. And he said east, so you can suppose with some degree of certainty that it was more or less in a line east and not dispersed throughout Middle Earth. So some kind of northern picket line against the rear of Mormont in the north. Yes,
yeah, that makes sense.
Because it's really described that Aule made the dwarves tough and very hard to endure the Middle Earth that was ruled at that time by Morgoth.
His version.
Yes, his version. He had a rough version of how the later children, the elves and men, would look alike, but he did not knew very precise. So he made them as best as he can, but he made them with very tough features to endure the hardships in Melkor's Middle Earth. So it might be, it's not very unreasonable to assume that they were, the awakening places were located in a line of about approximately from here to here, in mountainous areas, of course. And that the, and he says that the migration radius, so to say, of dwarves was very, very limited. They did not, they are not very prone to migrating very long distances unless in a very, very great duress. And we have the example of Durin's tribe, from which we know that they had very, very many misfortunes. First, they had the Balrog in Moria, and afterwards they had the dragon in Erebor. And if you draw, if you take Gundabad as a middle and draw a circle to the utmost regions where they, where Durin's tribe went, you get a good, it's a near perfect circle here. When you hit here, take it here, the Eredwin, where Thorin Oakenshield had his temporary residence, you get a circle that is bounded here at the Ered Nimeris, or in the Eglaron area, and in the east here at the Iron Hills. It's a very good tool, and then you can take this radius as the
model,
as a model, as the biggest radius that the dwarven tribe under very, very great stress and duress would travel. And so it's region of activity, so to say. Then you can take the supposed other awakening places, draw a circle of similar radius around them, and then you have a very rough but workable imagination where you could expect to dwarven settlements in later ages.
I thought the
Morgoth's
That's
a different issue, of course, okay. Because the dwarves never delved that deep.
Yeah.
Or perhaps they delved that deep one time and they got the Balrog from that.
Yeah.
And so this underdeeps might be traversing all these places by chance or even by...
Mainly on the north side and across.
Yeah, for example.
Yeah.
But for the dwarves, I guess they... At least if they keep their wits, they would not delve too deep. In Moria, they only delve so deep because they were so greedy for the Mithril.
Yeah.
And that was only found ever, ever deeper, and because they wanted it ever, ever more, influenced by the ring, of course, they grew deeper, 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 and sometimes they came not only Mithril, but another creature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
first great misfortune.
One thing
comes to
mind. Yeah, but that's always something I thought would be a fun adventure scenario. It's having a group of adventurers explore some person.
And of course, many of the underdeeps, especially in the north, would be flooded by the catastrophes of flooding Angband and flooding Tumnu before. So there would only be a fraction of the underdeeps available or traversable in the Third Age compared to the ones in the first or even the second
one
age.
Very effective.
But interesting nonetheless, certainly a challenge for any third age party.
Yeah. What do you think the biggest difference is between a second age and a third age party? Why would it be easier for a second age party to?
Because in earlier ages, at least to Tolkien, the individuals were much more powerful. He has this quite ancient idea or tradition that the best thing you could have and the most powerful in the beginning when they are created, and the farther you get down the time, the more diluted, the more less powerful everything gets. So when you imagine the first age
you had Elven and even Manish Warriors able to stand single against Dragons or Balrogs, and then you shift back to the Third Age and see who of the Third Age characters might be able to stand its own against a Balrog. That's not very many.
But a well-organized party that were experienced, that happened to have nice equipment, might have a chance.
That is always a question. These equipment is magical equipment of time. It's always a question how great you set the level of magic available, of battle magic, of the classic AD&D battle magic.
Yeah.
The classic AD&D battle magic is, in my opinion, absolutely nonsense for Middle-earth. Throwing fireballs, throwing lightning bolts, and obliterating whole companies with a single stroke of your finger.
Yeah, but that's the only chance. I mean, chance third age group we have is if they came across first and second age artifacts.
But that's an approach. You come from the gaming system and see with what rules I can manage to overpower Balrog, for instance. But my approach is what. When I look at Tolkien, you had not, even in the First Age, that were not powerful wizard blasting the orc armies away with fireballs or thunderstorms or something like that, but it was always, even in the First Age, it was handiwork. It was armies that clashed against army, and not battle magic, whatever. So even Húrin and Fingolfin, all the great names from Silmarillion, did it in the old-fashioned way.
But there were still items that were described as very powerful.
These were described as very powerful.
Those were very primitive too. Because the magic of Middle-earth was not very powerful.
And it's always an issue as well. The magic is declining. In the First Age, you had the most powerful equipment, but Tolkien is also very reluctant to say magical item, magic sword or something like that. He describes it as a good workmanship. And it is not a magical item in the classic sense. It gives you a bonus to hit something or make damage or something like that. But he says it's a very sharp sword or something like that. And even then, it might snap or get lost.
Oh.
When you have a close look at the description of the aftermath of the Anuin, and the big fifth battle that were lost by the elves and men against Morgoth, Morgoth ordered his orcs to assemble all the fallen elves and men. They piled them up in a great heap, and this was the small hill that was there afterwards until the changing of the world, until the War of Wrath. And Tolkien says, and under this hill, the swords of the Edain and the Elder rusted. It's not a magic sword that's you lay it here and it does not rust or does not decompose.
Right.
If it can deteriorate as well, it's not automatically protected just because it's made by an elf or an Elaine from the First Age. So it's a very delicate question how much battle usable magic is available, either in the form of items, even more in the form of items, but certainly not in the form of powerful metal magic spells.
Well, it just seems inconsistent. Because if what you're saying is true, how could someone like Fino come along and create Sumer Elves?
Yeah.
And then someone like Morgoth wants them so badly, yet he can create dragons.
Yeah,
so right. There's something going on.
The thing you must consider always is that Morgoth, for all his power, he could not create anything of its own accord. He had to use something existing and model and mold it and modify it according to his own wishes. He could not take a lump of clay and make an orc out of it. It would only a puppet that could move like Aule made with his dwarves. It could only move when he had his will upon them.
Right.
So the basic issue with Melkor and Sauron after that could only modify existing things to their wishes in some degree or less, but they could not wholly create a living creature wholly out of themselves.
And then you had the Rings of Power, of course, and it's clearly very powerful.
If you look at the magic that is described by Tolkien, it is not this classical magic. You have a spell or a spell list or something like that. The most powerful items, like the Silmarils, the rings, are always created when the maker put something of his own essence, so to say, into his creation.
Right. That's the reason they're drawn to it.
Sauron puts some of his own essence, of his soul, so to say, into the ring. So this was a conscious item, and he had to do this because the rings that the elves had made, especially Celebrimbor had made, were very, very powerful on their own accord. Celebrimbor, neither Celebrimbor could recreate the third rings had he survived the war against Sauron. He could have made, not said, oh, nice rings, we could use more of them, I make another series. He had expended his energy or his ability. He could not recreate such items. These are the Valar, they're not able, after Melkor destroyed the two trees, to simply regrow them. As Yavanna said, even the Valar can do some things only once. And if then it's destroyed or modified or turned to evil, it's gone. So for the Silmarils it's the same. Fëanor could not simply say, oh, Melkor had stolen this, no matter, he can keep that and make three new. Even if the two trees had existed still, he could not give as much into his creation as well.
Okay.
And that was the matter how Morgoth